We're going to do a little chant, the Sabbe Sata Sukihonto chant. And then as we chanted, mostly the people kind of near the front just pass it around and just hold it for a moment and just kind of think good wishes for this wonderful baby girl. And then we'll pass it around and give it back to me. And then the Sabba Sata Sukihonto means may all beings be happy. And then between each time we say it, we can all take turns, not all of us, some of us can take turns, wishing a blessing on her, wishing her well, or some kind of nice wish for what we'd like to see her have in her life. So, besides food. So, I think most of you probably know it, and those of you don't can catch on to the chant. So, Sabbe Sata Sukihonto. May you grow up to be fully happy. Sabbe Sata Sukihonto. Sabbe Sata Sukihonto. Sabbe Sabbe Sukihonto. Sabbe Sata Sukihonto. Sabbe Sata Sukihonto. Sabbe Sata Probably enough. The baby blessing shouldn't be too unhappy of an event.
Oh. They should at least have refreshments.
Yeah. So you should know there's a whole community of people here who want you to be really happy and contented and well fed. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay. Is.
She hasn't told us yet.
Thank you. So, in apropos the issue of names, maybe some of you don't know that the name the Buddha is not really a proper name. It's not like a given name, but rather it's a title. Perhaps a little bit similar to the way Christ is a title, and it's a word. The word Buddha is used even today, I understand, in India, to refer to someone kind of popularly. To just a learned person or a wise person. It's not someone who's knowledgeable, well-learned or wise. And back in the Buddhist time, it just kind of had a similar kind of meaning. The word itself comes from the root bud, which means something like to be awake, to awaken from a slumber, from a sleep, to know, to understand, something like that. And so from this comes the idea of be awake. And this was adopted by the Buddhists, by the Buddha, as his name after he became enlightened, after he became awakened, after he woke from the slumber of confusion of people. And so we call him now the Buddha, the awakened one. And in talking about in choosing this as a title for the founder of Buddhism, it reminds us over and over again that one of the central elements of Buddhist practice, the Buddhist experience, is the importance of awakening, or is the importance of knowing. Our ability to know things, a very simple ability that all of us have. It's pretty routine. As I said last Thursday, it's not the mystic East doesn't have a monopoly on knowing. Knowing is something we all do all the time. Each of you listening to me, in order to hear my voice and hear my words, you're using your knowing to register that and to receive it. And that ability to just hear my voice and to register it, or to hear the bird or whatever, that knowingness is one of the key elements, that the ability to know, one of the key elements of Buddhist practice. And the name Buddha for me points back to something very common that we all experience, we all have. But a Buddha is someone who, for whom the ability to know has become clarified or strengthened or purified or become central or become freed. Maybe it's the best way of saying it. His ability to know, the knowingness of the mind itself, has become freed. And what happens to many of us is the ability, our very simple ability to know things, to sense things, gets very much entangled with other activities and functions of the mind. So what I wanted to do tonight was to distinguish. It's not absolute distinctions, but kind of just kind of useful distinctions, perhaps, between three aspects of the mind. One is what's called the contents of the mind. And so if I touch my thigh and feel the contact, feel the pressure, feel the warmth, that's the raw sensation of that in Buddhist psychology is called a content of mind. It's something that we can know. And what's knowable directly by our senses is the content of mind. And there are six sense doors to receive the content of mind. There's the five senses that we know about, and the Buddhists add a sixth one, which is there's a kind of a sense organ in the mind that registers very simply as contents of mind what we in the West would call mental experience. Thoughts, for example. The reason that we know we have thoughts in Buddhist psychology is because there's an organ in the brain or somewhere that kind of senses the fact that a thought has happened. Or feelings or emotions inside of us, we can be aware, they can be knowing that these things happen. So it's very kind of very simply, there can be a thought and there's a knowing of it. There can be a sensation and knowing of it. The sound of the bird and there's knowing, there's kind of knowing of it that happens at the same time. Sensing is perhaps a good, better kind of word for it. So content of mind, very simple kind of experience. The second category, or second division of way to break up the mind, is the activity of the mind, or the reactivity of the mind, or the involvement of the conscious mind. And so we don't just simply allow things to be there, content of mind to be there, but we get involved in it. And there's likes and dislikes, there's preferences, there's aversions, there's judgments of good and bad. There's wanting and grasping onto things, just pushing things away. There's a phenomenal kind of amount of movement of mind for and away and about things that goes on. So it isn't just simply we hear a sound of the bird, but we hear the wonderful sound of the bird arises in the knowing. There's a knowing, a sensing of that sound of the bird, and then the mind starts going off, moves, the mind gets active, and it says, well, that's really peaceful, it's peace-producing, it's very nice. Maybe I should go to the pet store and buy a few canaries and have it in my house. It wouldn't be really nice, but then if I buy it from my house, my landlord doesn't allow pets, and that's not so good, and maybe I should kind of have an argument with my landlord, or better still, maybe I should move, but rents are so expensive here, and so maybe I better get a new job first. You know, so you know the story, right? So the activity of the mind begins to kind of go off. Sometimes it's called a proliferation of thoughts and activities. And it can be feelings and emotions and all kinds of things get get triggered. And these two things often are so entangled with each other, the content of the mind, the raw sense experience of, oh, there's a thought, or there's a feeling, or there's a sound of a bird. We're so entangled with the activity, the movement, the activity of the mind, the conscious involvement of the mind, that we kind of don't see them as being two separate things. We don't see, for example, that when there's a sound of a bird and we have a preference for that sound, we don't see the preference and the sound maybe as being really so separate. And it can be very freeing for people to realize that having a desire, which can arise simply as a kind of content of mind, simply sense that desire, desire itself doesn't have to be acted on. It can just arise there and be there, and it doesn't have to be acted on. And I know people, some people, for example, who have addiction difficulties, have found tremendous kind of freedom in realizing that they don't have to buy into their desire. The desire can be there, and there doesn't have to be an activity of mind in association with the desire. So one of the interesting things about the activity of the mind, much of it has to do with discursive thoughts, thinking about things, is that it's often self-perpetuating. It fuels itself. So suddenly you're thinking about birds, and you think about getting a pet, and then there's your landlord, and then you're upset about your landlord, and it fuels a lot of emotions. And then because of these emotions, it fuels the idea to get another job, and it goes on and on, kind of fuels itself. And if you follow and watch your mind in the course of a single day, or a single hour, normal kind of activity, you sometimes can actually kind of track how one kind of chain of associated thought or feeling or emotion triggers another and triggers another and triggers another. And it can kind of spiral and whirlpool and kind of go on and on and on. And if we're lucky, it kind of goes on at a nice, smooth kind of pace. And if we're not so lucky, it might escalate and gets tighter and tighter and tighter for us. And a tremendous amount of stress gets put on our brain and our body as a result. And our culture, I believe, very much reinforces the active side of the mind, the active movement of the mind, always being engaged and actively doing things, because our culture values a lot activity and doing. It values power and acquisition and achieving things. And to some degree, most of us think in order to achieve and acquire and do and be successful, there has to be a lot of conscious activity of the mind in order to succeed. And so we kind of get onto that treadmill of mental activity, and it gets faster and faster and faster. Buddhists don't say it's bad to have mental activity. Buddhist psychology says it's inevitable. You can't not have it. But the difficulty is when we get stuck in the middle of it and we don't see any way out. It kind of escalates and moves, kind of fuels itself on and on. I saw it quite dramatically this last week myself. I was on where I was gone for the last 2 Mondays was I was on a retreat. I was sitting a retreat rather than teaching it, so that was quite nice. And so I spent about 7-8 days in silence and just sitting and doing a lot of practice. And by the time it was over, I was somewhat happy, pretty happy, more happy than I was going into the retreat. And so I came home, and I was pretty happy. And that was the main state of mind. And I had about 3 days before my wife and baby son was going to come home. Because while I was on retreat, they had gone back to my in-laws back in Boston. So my wife wouldn't have to be home alone, which made a lot of sense. So she actually stayed longer. So I had 3 days by myself at home. So I kind of appreciated that in some ways. But I also knew I had a lot of things to do. And I knew that once they came home, I better not be doing them. So I better kind of try to get as much done as I could before they come home. So I started doing things. And I started trying to be very efficient and do a lot of it. And after a day of this, kind of, I noticed that I had been in a happy mood, happy state of being. And nothing terrible had happened to me at all, except that I'd gotten very involved with activity of the mind, focused very much on different kind of focus on very different kinds of ideas and concepts and works and jobs. And one after the other, and my mind started getting busier and busier and busier. And I was so busy taking care of things, my mind was so busy thinking about all these things and going ahead to the next one, that I completely overlooked the fact that I was happy. And actually, after a day of being so busy, if I stopped and just kind of took a moment, I couldn't find the happiness just like that. So then that was a very powerful lesson in me. It was how easy it is to lose some very kind of normal and sense of well-being, perhaps, or ease, by how we get caught up in the activities, which our culture values so much. The activities of the mind. It's interesting that in Zen Buddhism, sometimes, they call these first two aspects of the mind that I'm talking about, the confused entanglement of the content of mind and the activity of the mind, conscious mind. They call it, when that's the whole world that we live in, we're kind of embroiled in the world, in this activity of mind, content of mind. It's called the small mind. And the content of mind, the thoughts and ideas that might arise, are not just simply things about the inner world, but much of the way in which we see the world around us is a projection of ideas that we have about the world. And so that when we're entangled in that also, we're living in the small mind, they say. So there's the content of mind, the very simple kind of raw experiences of things arising and passing, thoughts, feelings, emotions. There's the activity of mind when those get all entangled and moving and kind of a whirlwind sometimes of activity of the mind, conscious mind. And then there's a third aspect of mind. And this is a very important aspect for Buddhist practice. And that is the mind's ability to know. The knowingness of the mind, the wakefulness of the mind. The mind's ability to be aware. When I was thinking about this today, I was reminded about times I've been in near accidents. And how in the moments or the minutes, perhaps, after the accident or near accident, and I'm kind of in one piece, and I haven't been harmed, there's a kind of the knowing factor of the mind, the mind's ability to know or be aware, sometimes becomes incredibly strong and powerful. And when it becomes very strong in this kind of situation, there often seems to me to be a tremendous stillness present at the same time. Even though there are things still happening around me, there's a tremendous stillness that arises because that knowing faculty, the ability to know, or the awareness faculty, has become really pronounced and predominant in the present moment. And is this possibility to make it more pronounced or more predominant, the knowing aspect of mind, which is part of what happens in Buddhist practice. And this is its ability to be aware and to know that disentangles us in the treadmill of conscious activity of the mind and the constant projection of ideas and concepts we have on the world that we create, the contents of minds, for example. So part of the function of Buddhist practice is to begin helping us recognize and clarify this simple thing we've called the awareness. And awareness itself mostly goes overlooked because we're so involved in the activity of the mind. And, you know, our mothers say, you know, pay attention. My mother did. Pay attention to what you're doing. But I didn't pay attention to that. I didn't understand what she meant. And so most of us, you know, can say it's important to pay attention. But I think most of us, even those of us who practice, because even myself sometimes kind of lose track of it, don't value how incredibly precious and crucial to liberation is the mind's ability to simply be aware of what's happening in the mind. So it's interesting, some of the things that can be considered to be content of mind are such things as calm, peace, happiness. But they're content of mind, and when we want those things in our practice, then we want something that belongs to the content of mind, what we can sense, And we're focusing on that. Again, we're focusing on something which is not the awareness itself. And many people who do Buddhist practice are always focusing on something which belongs kind of generally to what I'm calling the content of mind. What they want from the practice. Calm, peace, joy, insight. All the things that the awareness can know. And that ultimately is not the point of Buddhist practice. The point of Buddhist practice is to discover this precious liberation that's possible in the knowingness itself, in the knowing itself. And knowing normally doesn't arise separate from what it knows. But we tend to be so involved in the content of stuff that we don't notice the knowing itself. Now, mindfulness practice is primarily a practice of bringing a careful attention, non-judgmental, non-reactive attention, to the first two aspects of the mind, to the, what I'm calling the content of the mind, the raw, basic experiences, building blocks of what of our experience moment by moment, bringing a careful attention to that, and bringing careful attention to the conscious activity of the mind, the feelings, the emotions, the thoughts, and whatever. And as we do that, not so much to understand, part of what happens is we learn to understand those better. But more importantly, as we keep doing that, and as we bring a non-reactive, non-judgmental awareness to whatever is happening for us, we're beginning to strengthen the knowing factor of the mind, the ability of the mind to know and to recognize things. And it's the image that sometimes given, it's a classic Buddhist image, is that of a lotus in muddy water. That the lotus is kind of symbolizes the knowing factor, the awakening awareness factor. And it exists entangled in the small mind, in the mud. And that as our ability to be aware and to be mindful to get stronger, our ability to know kind of becomes stronger and stronger and begins to blossom above the muddy water. And the idea with the lotus, the lotus that blossoms above the muddy water, is the white lotus is unstained by the mud. It kind of grows up through the mud and blossoms above it. And maybe it's not the best analogy for this, but this is kind of how it is with the mind. As the awareness becomes stronger and stronger, it begins, in a sense, to set itself free from the entanglements with all the content of mind or the conscious activity of mind. And this is what then in Zen they call the big mind as opposed to the small mind. And the big mind is the mind that has a knowing that's free, that in a sense holds everything in it, within it. Everything in a sense, because the whole experience we have of this room right now and all the people sitting in the room right now and the lights in the room and the ceiling and all that. There's a way, I mean, it doesn't make logical sense, but there's a way which, perhaps, but there's a way in which our experience of these things outside of us actually happens only in the context of those external things hitting our sense organs. Our whole experience of the world around us is happening here in who we are. The experience of the world is happening, everything is happening here. Or another way of saying it, perhaps, in Buddhist parlance, is that there's no inside and outside to this experience right here. Or there's no subject and object for this experience in the knowing itself. The knowing arises without any inside or outside, without any here or there. But the knowing of this room and the people in it simply happens in the awareness. And there's no conception that's created, that's added on top of that, oh, that's out here and that's out there and I'm in here. So maybe this doesn't make too much sense, but maybe we'll get to it in a couple of minutes. So what we're trying to do, what we do in mindfulness practice, is bring our knowingness, our ability to know what's happening in any given moment. And really kind of to bring a careful knowing over and over and over again, what is happening now, what is happening now. And as we do that, we do have a lot of insights, and a lot of wonderful things might happen. But we don't want to confuse the insights or confuse the wonderful things might happen with the strengthening of this knowing, with the blossoming of knowing, and the setting free of the knowing. We're setting our ability to know and be aware free from all the entanglements of the conscious activity of the mind and the content of mind, in a sense. So there's a really beautiful analogy which is used over and over again in almost all schools of Buddhism. Maybe different schools of meditation also. Probably many of you have heard it before. And that is that meditation is like settling a muddy pond, the water in a muddy pond. If you go to a muddy pond and you take a stick and you stir it all up, it stays muddy. And then if you kind of stop for a while and begin to settle, and then you come with your stick and stir it up again, it kind of agitates the water again. But if you just leave it completely alone and don't do anything to the water to keep agitating it, all the mud in the water will slowly settle. And with time, the pond will become completely clear. And when the pond is completely clear, then also, and really, really still, it reflects the things that come around the pond perfectly, or more or less perfectly, I guess, like a mirror. Just a little, and it doesn't judge what comes to the edge of the pond. You know, if you look over into the and see your reflection in the surface of the clear water, the water is not judging what it sees. The judging happens somewhere else. The water is just kind of allowing it to be there as it is. And this image of letting things be in the mind, mindfulness practice is really about not trying to change ourselves or manipulate ourselves, but using the knowing factor to just know things without trying to make anything happen or to make anything go away. There's no need to judge. And so one of the classic examples where meditators get into trouble is their attitudes around thinking, discursive thoughts. And they think that discursive thoughts, like the mud swirling up, you know, there's something wrong with that. I have to still my mind. I have to go back to my breath. You know, you notice yourself wandering off into thoughts. Oh, that's bad. And you kind of push it away and come back to the breath. And I saw this for myself with this retreat I was sitting the first day or two. I saw that I still, after all these years, I had a subtle judgment and aversion about my discursive thoughts. And I can see this very thing I'm describing, that a discursive thought would arise, and the kind of judgment I had was, oh, it's taking me away from where I'm supposed to be, which is the breath. And so, let's just, you know, I kind of, get away. Go back to the breath. But when you allow the pond to settle by itself, you don't make discursive thoughts a problem. They just become what you hold in the field of awareness. And if you don't get involved with them, with thoughts, if you don't get involved with the conscious activity of the mind, it kind of settles by itself with time. For the most part. Sometimes it gets, you know, more turbulent for a while, then it settles. But it doesn't matter. From the point of view of mindfulness, what we're trying to develop is the awareness of what's actually happening, not manipulating and changing what's happening. We're trying to have an unconstructed experience, unconstructed relationship with what's happening. Just allow things to be as they are, not to manipulate or change. And it's very powerful, this image of the pond settling, I think. You just allow things to be. You bring awareness to it. And awareness helps us to step outside of the entanglement. If we stay entangled, we just stare up the water. Now, one of the interesting ways of staring up the water is you're sitting there in meditation, and you're getting maybe kind of calm or whatever, maybe a little bit, and then you say, I'm not calm enough. Or, I'm not doing good enough. Or, I wonder how the person next to me is doing. Or, I think I could be doing better. Let's try harder. You know, we have all these different ways in which you start stirring up the mind rather than just letting it be. And one of the implications of this is that we tend to get so fixated or focused or believing in our discursive thoughts, in our thoughts. So rather than focusing on letting the awareness to be there with things as they are, we've been seduced into the thought, oh, I better do this better, or I'm not doing this quite right. And we kind of follow along, we kind of believe that thought, rather than believe our ability to know. Does that make sense? Now, if you see this distinction, it gets quite fun in meditation. Because in pure meditation, we just simply bring knowingness or awareness to what's happening in a very simple kind of way. A knowingness, awareness, is not the same thing but not the same thing as thinking about things. So if you think your meditation is poor, or if you think your meditation is really good, it doesn't really matter. It's just thoughts, just more discursive thoughts. From the point of view of pure practice, we're just trying to know what's going on. So it's kind of a practice where you can have all the thoughts you want in the world, you're doing it wrong. And you're not really doing it wrong. Don't pay any attention to thoughts saying you're doing it wrong or you're doing it right. Just come back to knowing what's happening in the present moment. No, I'm having this kind of thought. I'm having a kind of thought. I'm a human being now who's having a kind of thought that I'm doing it wrong. Isn't it interesting? Don't believe those thoughts. As long as you can come back and just rest in the knowing and the awareness of what's actually happening. Come back to the knowing and knowing. Always come back to the knowing. And the knowing is incredibly simple. You hear the sound of the bird? Maybe not now, but you hear the sound of my voice. You know, it's very simple to know something. So as the pond settles and the water becomes clear, then the surface of the water becomes mirror-like. And a mirror also is a famous analogy in Buddhism for the mind or for practice. Because the mirror just reflects what's there clearly for what it is. It doesn't care what comes in front of it, whether it's clean or dirty or whatever. And it doesn't judge it. It just kind of reflects it as it is. And that is what the opportunity exists in practice when we develop and strengthen our knowingness, our awareness, is the knowingness becomes a mirror. Oh, look at that. That's happening. Oh, that's happening. That's happening. The awareness itself never judges. And we want to strengthen its ability, kind of polish the mirror is also a famous problematic story in Zen Buddhism, polishing the mirror. And then it's said in Buddhism, and it's very interesting, it's said that in many different schools of Buddhism, including our Theravada Buddhism, our school, it says that the fundamental mind or awareness is radiant, is luminous, I think radiant is probably the best translation. The basic mind of awareness is radiant. However, what happens is that various visitors, filters, screens, various conscious activity of the mind infuses itself into that radiance and kind of dulls its luster. And sometimes it completely blacks it out. But as awareness itself becomes stronger and stronger, we get a sense of its radiance or its tremendous clarity or beauty or purity. That's always there, it's said. The kind of the metaphysics of it is it's always been that way from the beginningless time. But the important thing is to kind of develop, strengthen this ability simply to know things as they are in the moment. And in a sense, let me say this, there's a very famous sutta, a teaching of the Buddha called the Sutta to Bahiya, the teachings to Bahiya, which describe this. Bahiya was a man who had only a short time to live, and he didn't know that exactly, but the Buddha knew it. And maybe Bahiya had some intuition about it because he came to the Buddha and said, "You got to tell me right now, in brief, what your essential teaching is." And the Buddha said, "Well, maybe not right now." And he said, "No, it has to be right now." And the Buddha said, "Well, yeah, you're right. I better tell you right now." So the Buddha said, "In the herd, just let there be the herd. In the seen, just let there be the seen. In the cognized, let there be the cognized. When you can let the seen be just a seen, and the herd be just a herd, and the cognized just a cognized, then there's no here or there, no inside or outside. And if there's no here or there, then the mind becomes free." When there's no dualism of separation in the knowingness, it's just knowing happening. There's no one knowing. There's no here subject who's knowing anything, and there's no object out there. But the awareness, the sensing of experience arises in the moment, and we allow it to be just as it is. We allow sensations to be there as they are, without getting entangled with them. We allow emotions to arise without getting entangled with them. We allow feelings to arise without getting entangled. We allow our thoughts to arise without getting onto the thought train. And then off we go in all kinds of, you know, wonderful trips. Just allow things to be there in the simplicity and let them, in a sense, self-liberate. To allow them to be there and not get entangled with them. And as we do that, the awareness becomes stronger and stronger. And we realize that we liberate our awareness from the entanglements with the conscious activity of the mind, and we liberate the conscious activity of mind from itself. It's very nice. Now, an appendix to this talk is as we learn to trust the mind's ability just to know things and allow ourselves to rest in just knowingness and awareness. I was very careful today to distinguish that from the conscious activity of mind, where we get entangled. But it seems to me that there's a whole level of, I don't know if subconscious is the right word or what the right word is, but there's a whole level of working of the mind or the heart or ourselves that actually happens quite a bit out of our conscious kind of involvement that can often take care of things just fine by itself. And I think it's actually possible to trust much more than most of us realize. That if we rest just in the knowing of things and allowing things to be as they are without getting entangled with them, that some kind of deeper subconscious or something, wisdom or understanding of how to respond, will arise within us. And more often than not, there should be some common sense involved, but some sense of that this is really appropriate to respond this way. In some schools of Buddhism, they make a whole metaphysics about this idea, where they think that they say that, you know, there's this ability to know is the Buddha nature, or emptiness, and emptiness itself is tremendously wise, and it's the wisdom of emptiness that speaks, or the wisdom of emptiness which acts in response to the world, or the Buddha nature itself is what comes up with solutions of what to do. But it seems like the subconscious mind or something can process things and work things out, and somehow things happen. And I see that often in my own life. Sometimes I'm kind of amazed at what seems to come out of my mouth or what kind of activity I tend to do if I'm kind of resting in the knowingness and the awareness of it all. And I know how painful and how easy it is to get very self-conscious. And so self-conscious is to be involved in the activity of the mind, the conscious activity of the mind. And then maybe entangled in it. And then the subconscious wisdom or processing or whatever doesn't have the same chance to work if the self-consciousness, the activity of the mind, is kind of covering it all. So I say all this as an appendix because some people feel that maybe they can't trust resting in the knowing. Just let the seen be the seen and the heard be the heard and the cognized being cognized. Just allowing things to arise and be there as they are without trying to change them or manipulate them or get consciously involved. Some people think, well, that's foolish, or I won't get my shopping done, or whatever you need to do. But actually, I think we can trust that things, that the motivations will come. So, that's all came for me. So, is that okay? Mm-hmm. Yes, Kathleen.
Something happened to me today. Actually, my husband and I were talking about it on the way over in the car, and I'm wondering how this fits in the scheme of things that you were just talking about. I found myself this afternoon, and I had a really great self-conscious rant going. I mean, I was really... But at the same time this whole thing's going on, there's another part of me that's kind of just watching it go on. You know, it didn't stop it. If anything, it was slightly bemused or something.
Was there enough awareness watching this that I don't know what. It sounds like you were angry, right?
Well, I was.
Maybe say it this way.
Kind of.
So there was enough awareness and presence there that you were unlikely to act unwisely on that ranting and raving.
I think so.
Then that's perfect. Just let that knowing be there. Just allow it to be there. You don't have to interfere or do anything about that ranting and raving, except hold it there in awareness. And you can bring more awareness to it if you can see the difference between the two. But that's beautiful.
Yeah, because I've tried to figure out if this is just two levels of mental activity going on, or it's, you know,
the awareness and
or it's actually the awareness you're talking about and the mental activity. Do you see what I mean? I mean, where's the distinction between just another level of thoughts going on, watching this first level of thought, and
I see. Well, it could all be going on. I mean, knowing is very simple. Knowing, in a sense, is non-discursive. It's not. So there can be the knowing of something like that, but there could also be another level of thoughts. So there could be everything's going on. You know, there's your primary thought about your ranting and raving. There's your thoughts about, oh, isn't this interesting? There's a knowing of it. I'm not acting on it. And you know, there seems to be two different things here. There's knowing and there's thinking about it. And your thoughts not realize that actually there's three things going on. There's your ranting and raving. You're thinking about the, you know.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you.
But it is important to try to keep it all simple. Maybe one more comment or question? Yes.
I was going to say, I recently read a description when you talked about your appendix of the subconscious, kind of intuitively maybe knowing what to do in a situation. This author was referring it to the subconscious more about, she called it the inconscious, meaning consciousness that's part of your native existence as a human being, perhaps inside in your cells and your body. And calling it the inconscious, which is not something we're aware of consciously, but
that's interesting. It's like that. It's kind of nice, because subconscious and unconscious have so many associations and connotations. It has a new word like that. It's kind of inconscious. Yes.
Just a quick thing. I just wanted to appreciate the fact that you tried to give words to or explain things that are really hard to explain, but that. You know, some of us may or may not experience from time to time or whatever. It helps. It's I don't know how to say it, but those kinds of things are really hard to verbalize, and it's nice to get that from you.
Well, thank you. I left the retreat, this last retreat, when I sat thinking that, you know, here I teach awareness and knowing and all these things, and actually I don't know what I'm talking about. So, thank you. And so, anyway, be well, and may your knowingness flower.